For the
quiz?
For the first one?
Mm-hmm. Mine went down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, mine went down because it was like heavy. Yeah. I think our betas were.
Okay, folks, the usual rules apply. I will, as soon as the quizzes are graded, I will let you know. And the grades will go up on Brightspace. You can either come pick up your quiz or you don't have to. I don't care. But you can always check your score. Okay? So let me at least list out what's left in the class in case you haven't been keeping tabs. Your final project is due on May 9th, which is the last day of class, which is less than 2 weeks from today, right? It's 2 weeks from day before yesterday, so May 9th. Your final exam, the regular scheduled exam, is on May 16th, which is the Monday following, but there will be an early exam on May 12th. For those of you who want to kind of mop it up, get done, leave. That exam will be from 10 to 11:50, and I'll send you the details. It's in the morning, 10 to 12 on Thursday. So if you need to leave before, by the end of the week, you can get the early exam out. And there will be different exams. So in a sense, I don't want people complaining that the exam they took was more difficult. I didn't try to make one exam more difficult than the other, but they're different exams. So, you know, you can take your pick either Thursday or Monday. Any questions before we start? Because last session we were talking about how the dividends you pay creates a shareholder base that likes your dividend policy. So help me out here. If you pay high dividends, in terms of individual investors, you're going to attract younger or older. You tend to attract older investors, poorer investors, investors like dividends. What about institutional investors? We look at mutual funds. Remember, mutual funds can be broken down into value funds and growth funds. If you pay large dividends, which of those two groups will you attract? Value funds tend to invest in low P stocks, mature companies. Growth funds obviously invest in higher growth companies. You're going to get a lot of value funds. You're probably also going to get pension funds because pension funds like to get the cash flows from dividends without selling stock. So you acquire a dividend clientele that likes what you do. And that works as long as you don't have to change, right? So if you're a nice mature company, you can afford to pay dividends. You can say, look, I want those kinds of people holding my shares because they don't put in unrealistic expectations on me to grow at 15% a year. They accept 6% growth and a nice solid dividend. But things can change. You know, if you go back 40 years when AT&T was broken up into 7 different phone companies, each of the phone companies was broken into had a monopoly. Right? At that point, the only way you could have phone services through the phone company. So you had nice stable earnings, they paid big dividends. So you're a phone company. Historically, you've paid big dividends. Why? Because your earnings are stable, you don't have much reinvestment to make. And then sometime in the 1990s, you became a telecom company, a technology company, because there are other ways in which people were getting phone service. So you're the CEO of a phone company. Historically, you've paid big dividends. You've attracted people who like those big dividends. But now things have changed. You have far more reinvestment needs than you used to because you're now a technology company. You're far riskier. So here's my question to you. As a CEO, you now have a mismatch. Mismatch between what your dividends, your historical dividends are, and what you can expect to pay in the future. So I'll give you 4 choices, and I want you to tell me which one of these you would pick as the CEO of the company. The first is, you get in front of the shareholders you've accumulated already and tell them courageously that you've decided to change dividend policy. What is that going to mean? You're going to cut dividends, maybe not to zero, but by 50%. And you tell them it's because we're now a technology company, we need to reinvest more. That's choice one. The second choice is you continue to pay the dividends you used to and put off reinvesting in the new business. The third is you continue to pay the dividends you used to. You issue new shares to kind of cover the shortfall. And you hope that nobody notices. Or you borrow money to cover the shortfall. So basically, that's a 4th choice, I guess. So if your objective is to set something reasonable for the long term, which one should you do? the first one, right? You go in and say, look, we're not an old mature company anymore. We can't pay the dividends. Only problem is, if part of your objective is to not get fired, I would strongly recommend that you don't do that. You know why? Because the people, I mean, what do they say? Read the room. If this is a room full of existing shareholders, who's in the room? People who love dividends. And what are you telling them? I'm not paying you what you like, which is dividends. No matter how rational your explanation, they're not going to like it. In the late 90s, phone companies ran into exactly this problem. Some chose to continue paying dividends and issue new shares, a few. Many chose to pay dividends and borrowed money to cover those dividends. But there was one very interesting twist that you saw that AT&T did with its to kind of capture this problem. You know what they did with their technology part of their phone company? They spun it off as a standalone company. It's called Lucent. It was a technology company, and essentially every AT&T shareholder was given a choice. You want to stay with AT&T where we'll pay these nice big dividends, or do you want to exchange your shares for Lucent shares where you will receive no dividends? It's in a sense having your cake and eating it too, because what you're giving investors is a choice. So sometimes when your dividend policy doesn't match what you're doing, you got to get creative if you want to preserve your job and do the right thing. Yeah, go ahead.
But in that case, wouldn't you lose? I guess part of the idea is using the cash flow from the dying.
Yeah, you let Lucent go out and raise capital on its own, right? So in a sense, that's what other technology companies do. And if you're a good technology company, you have no trouble. You see why they did in the 1990s, right? It's dot-com boom, you're a technology company. And Lucent soared during the dot-com boom. It crashed and burned for other reasons. But basically, you've essentially created a separate choice for shareholders to say, look, I'll take the growth over the dividends. Now, technology companies are facing the opposite problem. In the 1980s, every technology company was a growth company. Why? Because technology has just started as a sector. IBM might have been the grandfather of that sector, but almost every company had been founded in the 70s, the 80s, they were all young growth companies. So if you look at those companies, for the first 20 years, almost no technology company paid dividends. Intel didn't pay dividends, Microsoft didn't pay dividends, Apple didn't pay dividends. And it made sense. They were growing companies. They needed the money for reinvestment. But technology companies age. And in fact, they age faster than traditional companies. They grow fast. They have high earnings and cash flows. They start to become mature companies. Intel was probably the first of the technology companies to run into this problem, which is they were now a mature company, but their history was that accumulated shareholders who didn't like dividends. And they had lots of cash to return. Now do you see why stock buybacks are not going to go away anytime soon? Because if you're a technology company and you want to initiate cash returns and you don't want to piss off your existing shareholders, and there's pressure on you to return the cash, rather than start dividends and dig a hole for yourself, what are you going to do? You're going to return most of your cash, all of your cash in the form of buybacks. So watch for transitions in businesses because you're going to see it play out. So first good reason for paying dividends is your investors like it, and they like it, you give them more, as long as the underlying dynamics of the business don't change. Let's take a second reason for paying dividends. There's this whole area of finance called signaling. In finance, we take these common sense ideas, we call it an area, we do a lot of research in it. We all signal, right? In fact, if you go for an interview, what's the first thing you do? You go spend money on a $3,000 suit. It's not going to make you smarter or make you more informed, but you want to signal you're serious. How do you signal? You spend money. You say, look, I spent $3,000 on this suit. I must really want this job. It's kind of a weak signal, but it's a signal nevertheless. When you pay dividends, you are signaling. You're telling the market something about your future prospects. And there are two different signals you can send from the same action. Historically, if you look across all companies, increases in dividends have operated as positive signals. And I told you the reason for that. When a company increases dividends, it's telling the world, I feel sure, much more certain about the future than my peer companies. That's why I'm initiating dividends. And on average, if you look at dividend initiations, I'm sorry, dividend increases, the stock price jumps, but not by much. It's less than 1%. So don't expect 50% increases. So a company that increases dividends generally sees an increase in the stock price. And when companies cut dividends, you see the stock price drop, but it drops almost 5%. So I have a question. If why do dividend increases cause an increase of only 1%, but dividend cuts seem to cause a much bigger impact on the stock price? Want to try? What is it? What do you think the reason is? That's true, but why do they feel more strongly? Remember that graph I showed you, the number of companies that increase dividends and decrease dividends every year? What did you see? 4 to 5 times, maybe 8 times more companies increase dividends and decrease dividends. So already you can see that when companies cut dividends, it's far more unusual than when companies increase dividends. So as an investor, you're saying, there must be something really wrong at your company if you're cutting dividends. Dividend cuts tend to send signals that something is wrong with your company. It might not be true, but can you blame investors for reacting on that basis? But here's the other side of the signaling story. And some of you told me, you know, told the story last session. When a company initiates dividends, especially the first time, it's also sending a signal. A young tech company that you thought was a growth company starts to pay dividends. Part of you saying, but why are they paying dividends? I thought you were a growth company. The signal there actually might be that the future doesn't look as good. So if you look at, for instance, when dividends are initiated at companies, companies initiate dividends when earnings growth peaks. In other words, once they initiate dividends, if you track what happens in the period after the dividends, notice that growth comes down. It's not a surprise. Companies can see slowing growth coming and they try to get ahead of this by initiating dividends. Not surprisingly, therefore, when companies initiate dividends, you see stock prices decrease. In other words, a story can cut both ways, depending on the company. Across all companies, dividend increases historically have led to stock price increases, not by much, but dividend cuts have caused stock price drops. And in some companies, when the dividends are started, the stock price actually drops because people are surprised. They thought this was a growth company and they're getting a negative signal. But here's a bigger story cutting across time. These studies of dividend changes go back again almost 50 years. And if you look at dividend changes in between 1962 and 74, the effect of dividend changes, both up and down, were much greater than they are right now. In other words, for whatever reason, dividend changes have become weaker signals than they used to be of the future. Any hypotheses as to why dividends signal less now than they used to? As investors, how do you value a stock? You base it on information that's out there, right? 50 years ago, what did that information look like? If you were lucky, an annual report, if you could get your hands on it, there was no online equity research. If you paid a lot of money, maybe an equity research report, but there weren't as many equity research analysts. There's no online source you could go check out. There was no Twitter feed on the company. Dividends carried more information because you had far less information as an investor. Today, think of how much information we have on companies. I mean, dividends are a blunt instrument. It's almost like you're cutting yourself to tell people, look, I'm serious. Look, I'll cut myself to show you how serious I am. Because you're inflicting pain on yourself by increasing dividends. You don't want to do that unless you absolutely have. In fact, I'll go further. If you take the most liquid companies, the most followed companies in the market, I'll wager that the effect of dividends is close to zero. There's nothing you're really learning from Netflix by just looking at dividends that you couldn't learn by looking at all of the other information coming out about the company. So dividends are signals, but the signals are getting weaker over time. So dividend. So two potentially good reasons. One is you have a clientele that likes dividends. Second is you're trying to signal something about your future, which brings me to the ignoble reason for paying dividends. Remember I said you could use dividends to rip off your bondholders? What does that mean? When you borrowed money, the lenders to your company assumed a certain dividend policy. They assumed you'd pay out 30% of your earnings as dividends and they priced it in. If you pay 70 or 80% of your earnings as dividends, you're effectively making them poorer because they didn't price that in. So on average, if you look at what happens to bond prices when companies increase dividends, remember stock prices tended to go up by about 1%. If you look at bond prices in those same companies, they tend to decrease around dividend increases. As a lender, you look at a company paying more in dividends, say, I wish they didn't do that. So if I were to summarize the qualitative evidence, you can see all these multiple factors play out. So let me finish this section by looking at what CFOs and CEOs of companies believe about dividends. In fact, this particular survey asked them seven statements of what they thought dividends did, from dividend payout ratio affects the price of the stock, or management should be responsible. I'm going to focus in on the middle column. Notice on every single issue, what percentage of CFOs say, I don't know. I think dividend policy is a mystery to most CFOs. They have absolutely no idea what to think about dividends, which is one reason they tend to do what everybody else is doing. Because if you have no strong views on what dividends do to stock prices or whether they're good for you or bad for you, of course you're going to follow what other people do. So with that set up, I'm going to at least initiate a more detailed way of asking how much can my company return? Or put differently, is it returning too much cash or too little cash? So the point, the box I'm going to focus on is the very last box of all of this, of the six boxes, which is, hey, how much can a company return and in what form? So to set this process up, I'm going to give you two ways of assessing your company's dividend policy. This is the last stretch in your project. If you've done the capital structure, you're going to look at the company's dividend policy. The first is what I'm going to call the cash trust nexus. And I'm going to argue that your dividend policy is driven by two things: your capacity to generate cash and how much shareholders in your company trust the management of the company. And I'll talk about why trust is such a central component of dividends and whether how much you should return. The second way I will approach this is by doing what I did with capital structure. Look at the peer group and control for differences if I can, because I know that even if everybody else is paying dividends, if I am the growth company in this group, I should be paying less in dividends. So let's start with this cash trust nexus. And there are three basic questions I'm going to go through. The first question is going to be a very simple and easy question to answer. I'm going to look at my company and ask, how much has my company returned to its shareholders in cash flows? I'm going to look at both dividends and stock buybacks. So get that fact out of the way. And for many of you, be prepared for an answer that might surprise you, which is that your company has returned no cash. In fact, I will wager, even without looking at the numbers, that half of the companies you've picked don't return any cash to the shareholders. You know why? Because you tend to pick exciting companies, interesting companies. Who wants to look at Kraft Heinz? You want to look at Twitter. Or you want to look at Facebook. So the companies you pick, because they tend to be more exciting growth companies, tend to be companies that don't return any cash. Don't pass any judgment yet. Don't jump down their throat and say you should be returning more cash. That's the first one. Second question you've got to ask is, how much could my company have returned in cash? Sounds like a complicated question, but it's actually one of the simplest questions in corporate finance to answer. It's in your statement of cash flows. You can actually figure out how much your company could have returned. I'm going to call it free cash flow to equity, but that's just a fancy word for potential dividends. This is how much my company could have paid. So step one, you look at what your company actually paid out. Step two, you look at what your company could have paid out. And step three, if there's a disconnect between what it pays out and what it could have paid out, there's going to be a consequence for the company. If it pays out less than it can afford to, which a lot of companies do, guess what you're going to see at this company? You're going to see a cash buildup at the company. And remember what I said about cash? It's shareholders' cash, it's not the company's cash. And I'm going to ask you a question. Do you trust the management of this company with your cash? So how would I base the trust? What do we base trust on? When you look at another individual, what do you base your trust on? You base it on their past history, right? If they have a past history of lying to you, of course you're not going to trust them. If you have a past history of telling you the truth, you're going to, and with companies, it becomes when management says, trust us, you're going to look at their past history. And if they've been bad custodians of your company, When they say trust us, you say, why should I? Do you trust Twitter's management to run the company? Forget about Elon Musk. I certainly don't. 9 years in, they can't figure out how to convert users to money. If you don't have trust, you're not going to let a company take the kinds of actions it can. Conversely, do you trust Apple's management with your cash? I mean, they have $200 billion. And why do you trust them? It's not because Tim Cook, you know, goes to church. I don't know whether he does, but no, it's because they have a history as a company. They have a history of doing well for their shareholders. Trust comes from looking how well they pick projects and how well they've delivered returns. And I think we've answered both questions already. By the time you get to dividend policy, you should have the basis for answering the question, do you trust your shareholders? So let me start with the easy question first. I took my publicly traded companies and I looked at how much cash they'd returned. Three of the companies, Tata Motors, Baidu, and Deutsche Bank, two of the companies, Baidu and Deutsche Bank, had only dividends. In fact, Baidu returned no cash at all. Does it surprise me? Not in the least. So that's what I would expect to see, growth company, technology company. Deutsche Bank has returned cash. Its dividends have dropped off pretty dramatically, no buybacks. Tata Motors paid only dividends from 2008 to 11. 2012, for the first time, they initiated a little buyback. Vale's been doing both dividends and buybacks. They returned about $24 billion in dividends and $5.7 billion in buybacks. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why Brazilian companies get trapped into paying dividends that they can't afford to. It goes back to something we talked about in the context of corporate governance, voting and non-voting shares. And you're going to see it play out in dividend policy. And with Disney, you notice a phenomenon you're going to see with a lot of US companies. They return a lot of cash. They return almost $20 billion in cash, but most of it is now in the form of buybacks. So we know what these companies return. The question is, are they returning too much, too little, or do they have a Goldilocks dividend policy, just the right amount? So to answer that question, I'm going to come up, as I said, with my measure of potential dividends. To understand potential dividends, I want to make you the owner of a business. And I'm going to look at what cash is left in the till at the end of the year after you've met every conceivable need. So you're the only equity investor in the company, right? You're the owner. Let's start. Net income is your measure of earnings. Now, I know earnings are not cash flows. So to get to cash flows, what are you going to do? You're going to add depreciation because that's an accounting expense, but it's still a cash flow. If you have to make any big capital expenditures, that's cash out of the company. If you've got increased working capital, that's cash out of the company. And if you have to make debt payments, bank payments, that's cash out of the company. But if you also borrow money, that's cash coming into the company. So it's almost like you're sitting there with the checkbook counting, cash coming in, cash going out. After all of this calculation, I look at what's left in the till. If you're the private owner of a business, you can take that out of the business. It's your dividend. You might not call it that. It's what's left over after you've met every conceivable need. So free cash flow to equity is net income plus depreciation minus capex minus change in working capital plus net new debt issued because that's cash coming in minus debt repayment. I'm going to consolidate that because it's a little messy. 7 line items. I prefer to kind of consolidate and make it simpler. You take depreciation, capex, and change in working capital. If it's consolidated, capex minus depreciation plus change in working capital, that's basically what you're reinvesting back in the business. It's basically a measure of, are you putting money back into the business? And if you take debt outflows and debt inflows, that's net cash flow from debt. So free cash flow to equity is net income minus reinvestment plus or minus debt coming from cash coming from debt or cash paid out to debt. And there's an even simpler way in which you can. So these three equations are exactly the same. I'm just presenting them in different ways. If you have a company that upfront tells you, look, we raise 30% of our reinvestment from debt, and we're going to stick with that in the long term. Your free cash flow equity gets even simpler to calculate. You take the net income, you subtract out the reinvestment from just the equity part. All you care about is your cash flow. So you take your reinvestment times 1 minus the debt ratio. 70% comes from that. You got free cash flow equity. Take a look at the line items here. which financial statement are you going to find? So let's take the most detailed version of free cash flow. I need net income, I need capex, I need depreciation, I need change in working capital, I need debt issued, debt repaid. Which financial statement am I going to find every single one of those line items? The statement of cash flows. You're not going to find it in the income statement. You're not going to, you might get effects of it in the balance sheet. It's in the statement of cash flows. In fact, let's see, let's test your accounting knowledge. With there, if you remember, the statement of cash flows has operating cash flows, investing cash flows, financing cash flows, right? Where would I find net income? Which of those three groups? Starts at the top. In fact, the top line item statement of cash flows. What about CapEx? I'll find it in the investing cash flows, right? What about depreciation? You've got to go back to the operating cash flows. You're saying, why don't accountants do the sensible thing? Because they're accountants. If I were doing a statement of cash flows, I would move depreciation in with the investing cash flows and net it out, but they put it up there. What about change in working capital? You'll find in the operating cash flows, but it'll be really broken down into detail, right? Inventory, accounts receivable. Don't get distracted by all the detail. You consolidate all of that, you've got the change in working capital. And the debt cash flows are going to show up in financing. And if you stay on that same statement of cash flows, what else are you going to see in the financing cash flows? In addition to debt cash flows, you're going to see dividends. And you're also going to see stock buybacks. Everything is in there. For dividend policy, everything you need to assess a company is right there in the statement of cash flows. So when you have a company with a stable debt ratio, and there aren't that many companies where you can do that, you can compute the free cash flow to equity as net income minus the equity portion of your net capex, which is what you're investing in long-term assets, and the equity portion of your change in working capital gives you free cash flow. So let's try this on Disney. So what I've done here is started with net income, which I got from the statement of cash flows. I like to net out depreciation against CapEx. I call it net CapEx, but effectively it's adding depreciation, subtracting CapEx, minus change in working capital. There's my free cash flow to equity before debt payments. I take the net cash flow from debt. The net cash flow from debt will be positive if I'm borrowing more money than if I'm paying out. It'll be negative if I'm paying out more money than I'm borrowing. So it's going to switch from year to year. But the bottom line is, if you look at the free cash flow to equity, and I've also used the with the actual debt, it goes 7.4. So the collective free cash flow to equity I would have had with my full calculation is about $27 billion. What does that mean? During these 5 years, if Disney had paid out that calculated free cash flow to equity, they could have paid out $27 billion. Now, in some of these years, they did take on a lot of debt. So I said, if they'd been sticking with their existing debt ratio through this period, it's almost a hypothetical, what would their free cash flow to equity be? It'd be a lot lower because they were borrowing money and pushing up their debt ratio. I said, if they just stayed at the 12% debt ratio, they'd have had a lot lower free. But if you look at the free cash, they clearly had a lot of cash return, $18 to $27 billion, depending on what you think about the debt. They actually returned about $19.9 billion. So this is a company that is returning a lot of cash, but it has the capacity to return the cash. You're saying, what should worry me? If your free cash or equity of the 5 years were $5 billion and you're returning $20 billion, doesn't mean the company's insane, but it might mean that the company is trying to do something, you know, reduce cash that it had accumulated in previous periods. So what you're looking for is a mismatch between what the companies are doing and what they could be doing. Take another example. In 1996, Microsoft was 10 years old as a publicly traded company. It was a young company. It was growing. It was succeeding because Office was taking off. Windows, of course, had become pretty much the standard in most PCs. And I computed the free cash flow equity for Disney. The calculation was actually very easy. Their net income was $2.176 billion. Their CapEx and depreciation, you net them out, was the net CapEx was only $14 billion. So net income of 2176, net CapEx of $14 billion, and the working capital is $35 million. Before I go million. Before I go any further though, there seems to be a mismatch in the story. I told you it was a high growth company, right? It doesn't seem like they're reinvesting very much. how do I explain the absence of reinvestment at Microsoft? Because I'll tell you, they were actually reinvesting money. It just doesn't seem to be showing up in the numbers. No, even if it's an acquisition, it's a cash acquisition, it should show up in the statement of cash flows that I've captured.
It's because of the accounting, all of the investment goes through the income statement. So you.
In fact, what's the biggest CapEx for a Microsoft or a software company?
Probably R&D.
It's R&D. What do accountants do with R&D? They expense it. So in this case, the net income is already after their biggest reinvestment. I'm getting the free cash flow to equity right. I'm just missing the fact that they're really reinvesting more and are more profitable than they look on the financial statements. This is why you shouldn't take financial statements at face value. Because your first reaction is, they're reinvesting nothing. They must be doing something wrong. Take a look at how much R&D went into the net income. So in my valuation class, of course, I force people to capitalize R&D precisely for this reason, because it gives a cleaner sense of what's this company making and what is it reinvesting. The bottom line, though, is my estimate of free cash flow to equity was 2,127 million. What does that measure? How much they could have paid out, right? But let me complete the story. Microsoft paid no dividends, bought back no stock in 1996. So they returned nothing. So I have a very simple mechanical question. They generated 2,127 million in cash they could have returned. They returned nothing. Where on Microsoft's balance sheet would I expect to see that 2,127? And please don't say retained earnings. I know some of you are just jumping in, the accounting part of you jumped in. Put the accounting to the side. There's 2,127 million that they could have returned. They returned nothing. Could it be going into R&D? No, because it's net income. Could it be CapEx? No, I've already counted that. So where's the only place that you will see the 2,127 million? Anybody? Yeah, go ahead. It's an increase in your cash balance. In 1996, Microsoft's cash balance increased by 2.1 billion. In 1997, they had a $3.5 billion free cash flow equity, paid no dividends, bought back no stock. Their cash balance increases by another three. See, and it's accumulating, right? Each year you do this, what's happening to cash balance? It gets bigger. I'm always amazed when companies with big cash balance act like they're puzzled about how it happened. I don't know how we got out. This isn't manna from heaven that showed up on your balance sheet. This is a direct reflection of the fact that year after year, you've been generating free cash flows equity that exceed the dividends. In fact, a few years ago, I actually took Apple's cash balance, which is $200 billion then, and showed how it had built up over the history of Apple as a company, especially in the last 20 years. You can actually track how companies end up with cash balances. It's a direct consequence of not paying out what you can afford. Again, I'm not saying it's a bad thing or a good thing, but it explains how cash balances build up. Yeah.
Two questions. If we have a company that is growing in the period that we're analyzing a lot of acquisitions, should we compute like those?
My CapEx includes acquisitions. Okay. The problem though is, if it's cash acquisitions, I'll see it in the statement of cash flows. You know, the acquisitions that mess me up is the acquisitions you pay with shares. Because the information is there, but it's in the footnotes. If I really wanted to get the true free cash or equity for this company, I would need to go convert those stock acquisitions into value, bring it into my CapEx. It's a messy process. This is why valuing companies that grow through acquisitions, especially if their share base becomes much, much messier. Because the number is hidden rather than being made explicit. So that's how you get a free cash flow to equity for a software company, a manufacturing company. What if you have a bank? If I ask you, how much dividend can JP Morgan pay? You got net income, right? Help me out here. If I go the traditional route and I try to get from net income to free cash flow to equity, I will need to go get depreciation at JP Morgan. God help you with that. How about CapEx for a bank? No, you're even deeper hole. Working capital for a bank, in many ways, everything is working capital, nothing is working capital. You know what very quickly happens with banks is you give up. And then analysts say, well, because I can't get net CapEx change in working capital, net income is what I can afford to pay out, which is absurd because you really shouldn't be able to pay out net income as a bank and keep growing as a bank. So about 13 or 14 years ago, right after the 2008 crisis, until then, I'd never seriously thought about how do you estimate free cash flow to equity for a bank, because in a sense, you trust banks, at least until 2008. What does that mean? They pay out a dividend and say that must have been what you could afford to pay out. You're not going to do something stupid like pay a dividend when you cannot afford to do it. But 2008 dispelled that delusion. Banks do stupid things. So I said, I don't know whether you can afford to pay the dividend. So here's how I redefine free cash flow equity for a bank. I start with the net income. But when I think about what reinvestment you need as a bank, rather than think of net capex and change in working capital, I think of what you need to reinvest in regulatory capital. Remember, banks are regulated. To survive and grow, they need to maintain a regulatory capital ratio. If they don't maintain it, they either have to raise fresh equity or they will be shut down or absorbed into another bank. So if you're a growing bank, let's say you're a Southwestern bank, you're growing 10% a year. You have net income, but a lot of that net income has to be set aside to build up your regulatory capital to allow for your high growth. If you're an undercapitalized bank, how do banks get undercapitalized? No bank starts off saying, I want to be undercapitalized. How do you end up being undercapitalized? You start with a reasonable regulatory capital and you lose money. That, remember, every time you have losses, it comes, or you make a stupid loan, or the Justice Department fines you $5 billion for something stupid you did. Every one of these is a hit on your regulatory capital. So one way of thinking about free cash flow equity is say, look, I have net income. If I can estimate how much this bank has to estimate in regulatory capital, I can get free cash flow equity. So I did this for Deutsche Bank, which is a disastrous bank, but might as well pick a disastrous bank to see how much they can pay in dividends. They were losing money when I did this. I assumed over time their losses would turn to profits. In hindsight, terrible assumption, but let's stay with that assumption. I also estimated how much they will need to reinvest because they were at a 15.13. When you think about regulatory capital, there's all this language that banks use. Don't get intimidated by it. It's all determined by regulatory rules. Tier one capital, they'll say you can count this. Usually book equity is the constant. What they allow you to add to the book equity varies from tier one to tier two to tier three. So some allow you to add preferred shares, others don't. Some are allowed to add some portion of convertible debt, others don't. So tier one is the regulatory capital. And because the regulatory capital had dropped to a level they did not like, I targeted a ratio of 18%. They're an undercapitalized bank. What does that mean? They have to come up with regulatory capital over time to get from 15.13 to 18%. And it creates a hole in my cash flows. Why? They make 602 million euros in year one, but their investment in regulatory capital is 4.6 billion euros. My free cash flow equity is minus 3.99 billion euros. So what does that mean? Based on my calculations, Deutsche will have to issue new equity next year. Just forget about dividends. You're going to actually get diluted next year based on their free cash flow equity. So if you have a healthy, mature bank, your reinvestment will still be there, but it'll be relatively small. You will be able to pay a high dividend. If you have an unhealthy, mature bank, you might have negative free cash flow equity, partly because it's not making much money and partly because they're in this regulatory world. If you have a growing healthy bank, again, you go back to low free cash flow equity. You might be making money, but a lot of it has to go into regulatory capital that allows you to grow. So if you have a bank, and luckily none of you is doing a bank, that's part of the reason I steered you away from banks, is to do this, you got to get at least some degree of knowledge of regulatory capital. It's not a big deal, but it's tedious. So if any of you plan to work with banks or financial service firms, I would spend the summer investing some time and a lot of drudgery going through regulatory capital, how it's determined, how banks end up with different ratios. And incidentally, S&P Capital IQ has tier one, tier two, tier three capital ratios for every bank. Get a sense of perspective on what's high, what's low, what's typical across banks. So at the start of every year, I take all publicly traded companies in the world. As I said, 46,000. I compute the dividends for every company, dividends and buybacks. It's in there already. I just add the dividends and buybacks for every company. I compute the free cash flow equity for every company. Capital IQ reports every item in the statement of cash flow. So doing this for every company is not a big deal. It's just a gigantic Excel spreadsheet. And I end up with cash return and free cash return for every company. And then I do this table just for my own perspective on what do typical companies do. So let's take the first column. These were the percentage of global companies that had positive free cash flow equity and paid no dividends or bought back no stock. They returned no cash. So across the world, 14% of companies. That doesn't sound like much, but 14% of 46,000 companies is what, 6,000 companies have positive free cash flow equity and are returning no cash. What can I say about them? In 2021, which is the year that I looked at, they're increasing their cash balances by that free cash flow. Could it be good? Absolutely. Some of these companies, that might be a good thing. For some of these companies, it's a bad thing, but it's what it is. 23% of companies had, returned some cash, but they returned less cash than their free cash flow equity. So if you add those two numbers up, 37% of global companies, I'm going to call cash accumulators. Why? Because they're building up their cash balances by returning less than their share. And let's go across. So that's my green column. Let's go to the next column. You have companies with negative free cash flow equity. If you are advising a company with negative free cash flow equity and they said, how much should we pay in dividends? What's your answer going to be? Don't. You're in a hole. Stop digging. Thank God there are 31% of companies globally that take that advice. So they're doing the right thing. They have negative free cash flow equity. They're not, but remember, even though you're not paying dividends, you're still depleting cash because you have negative free cash flow equity. And then come the companies that I think are more difficult to explain away. You have companies that have free cash flow equity, but return more than that free cash flow equity, at least in 2021. And again, some of these companies, there's a good reason, right? We talked about commodity companies returning more cash than they can because they think prices will bounce back. So oil companies that did that in 2021 feel perfectly okay now because oil prices are up to $90, $95 a barrel. But some of those companies are choosing to return more than they can. And then you've got companies that are, I think, the most difficult group to explain. These are the companies that have negative free cash flow equity and continue to pay dividends or buy back stock. Because there, unless you have a really good reason and you think this is truly one time, you are digging a hole that's only going to get deeper over time. So I'm preparing you for any of those possibilities with your companies. When you get your company, you look at what they returned, you look at what they could have returned, be prepared for any kind of outcome because as you can see across the world, companies are all over the place. So let's talk about what this can do as you continually pay less than your free cash flow equity for a company. In the, when Microsoft accumulates cash, was treated very differently in 96 than Chrysler was. Now Chrysler, if you look back at its history, almost went under in the early 1980s. In fact, it was one of the first federal, it wasn't even a bailout. It was like a helping hand. They kind of allowed Chrysler to get through that crisis. But it still was the smallest of the three automobile companies, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Chrysler was always. And then in the, I don't know which year it was, a guy called Lee Iacocca took over Chrysler. And he came up with a vehicle that I still curse to this day because you run into it in every parking lot. What did Lee Iacocca create? He created the very first minivan, right? And now when you go around, there's minivans everywhere. And it saved Chrysler as a company. So what I've done here is actually graph out Chrysler's recovery from 1984 through 94, 85 through 94. So the white line is the net income each year. I'm sorry, the free cash flow equity each year. The black is the dividends returned each year. So in 1985, that almost 1.5 billion free cash flow equity paid out about 200 million. And I kept track of the difference as the increasing. So they started in 1985 with almost no cash. And by the time you get to 1994, as a result of going through this accumulation, they're up to 8.5 billion in cash. In a world where companies hold 200 billion in cash, 8.5 billion doesn't sound like much cash, right? But here's what should give you perspective. Chrysler's market cap as a company was $30 billion. $8.5 billion is cash. This is a company that's more than 25% cash. And unlike Microsoft in 1996, Chrysler came under pressure. An investor called Kirk Kerkorian. He's dead now, but he was an activist investor in the 1990s. Took a position in Chrysler and he pushed for change. And the biggest change he pushed was, you guys have too much cash, give me the cash. Or give us the cash, he's part of the shareholder base. And what was Chrysler's responses? No, no, we don't have too much cash, we need it. And if you're a cyclical company, what's the first excuse they use? There might be another recession, we need the cash for the recession. And even as they said it, they must have realized this story wasn't going to go, because if you look at this 10-year period, there is actually a recession in here. 1989 through 91 was a pretty severe recession, 1990 and 91. Did they burn through cash? Yes. They burned through about $500 million in cash. Let's do an algebra problem. If the last recession lasted 2 years and you burn through $500 million in cash, how long will the next recession have to last for you to need $8.5 billion? I think it's like 34 years. So you're basically preparing for a 34-year recession. That's like a guy who goes out in his backyard and starts building an ark every time it rains, and this could be the big one. You're going to be wasting a lot of time in your backyard. It didn't hold up. So Chrysler came back with a second reason. They said, we need the cash in case we want to do a big acquisition. Now, as Chrysler shareholders, does this make you feel a lot better? The history of big acquisitions is the one group that never seems to benefit from a big acquisition are shareholders in the acquiring company. Everybody else is happy. The bankers are happy. The target company is happy. That didn't fly as well. To cut a long story short, eventually Chrysler gave in to Kerkorian. They returned, I think, $3.5 billion in cash. They got bought by Daimler Chrysler, one of the most ill-fated mergers of all time, who thought it was a great idea to have this quintessential German company buy this Detroit-based auto company. I don't know, the cultural clash then played out in over a decade. But you can see why the pressure built up. And what I'd like you to do, if you can, because now the quiz is behind you, is compute the free cash flow equity. It's not rocket science. In the statement of cash flows, compute the free cash flow equity. Compare it in that same statement of cash flows to what the company could have returned. Try to do it at least over many years, because if you take 1 year, God only knows what it'll look like. So take 2021. 2020 is going to be a messy year, but bring it in 2019, 2018, 2017. Get a sense of, is your company accumulating cash or is it depleting cash? And then on Monday, when we start, we'll start with the framework of what do we do next? Should we put pressure on the company to return the cash if it's been accumulating cash, or should we give them kind of a free ride? And the answer is going to be surprisingly complex. It will depend on the company. So I'll see you on Monday and have a good week.
Hanging out here for lunch. I don't know. I was gonna do fucking work over lunch, but I'd be down to go play some. What around here is fucking good. Try a new place or we
It doesn't matter, you still have to make interest payments. It's still a contractual amount, right? It's not a kink. It'll just basically mean that at your optimal debt ratio, you're essentially re-rating them at every conceivable debt ratio, including the current debt ratio. And it'll mean the drop in your cost of capital will be far more dramatic than you're going to actually see. So one way to think about that is, let's say you're right now at a BBB rating, and the synthetic rating you get at the existing debt ratio is double that.
It's been a while.
That's like four rating notches. So if you take your optimal debt ratio, I would lower the rating you get at your optimal debt ratio by four notches. Well, just to say, look, I started at a much higher cost, much lower rating, higher cost of debt than you're assuming. I'm going to adjust for that at the optimal as well. So to basically bring your cost of capital up at every conceivable debt ratio. So all you do is you take the cost of capital you get out of the spreadsheet, and then take the cost of debt and move them by four ratings at every debt ratio.
Oh, really? Oh, sick. That
might not disappear, because remember we talked about cliffs. Cliffs can happen. That has nothing to do with the rating, existing rating. It's the fact that you hit this tipping point. You hit the tipping point, you start to spiral. Right, because each debt you take more debt, the interest coverage ratio drops, your rating drops, and it keeps spinning. So you're getting into that spinning point, and that's actually something to watch. So it might be something that'll show up no matter what you do. And that you might say, look, you know, at 40 is not optimal, but I get too close to that point, so I'm gonna stop.
I know, I would have barely done any growth steps, but I'm so like burned out. This semester would be so much fun for us.
Even though the reason why is 3%. So is this saying that if a company pays higher tax rate, their enterprise less? It's more, right? Because
I'm saying holding all of its content, this is just structure, right? If you adjust the earnings, you might now have an additional effect of, you know, lower your stuff. So it's because remember, we use pre-tax operating income. Yeah. So what we do, the fact is that the tax rate plays out only in the cost of that. Right? So you really are not making more money from that perspective. Now you really tax rate is lower. It doesn't mean you can borrow to make more money, but this is just focusing on the capital structure. You might be a more valuable company, more profitable company, but it doesn't mean you should borrow more. You should actually borrow a little less.
Okay. That makes more.
Start with the last material and work backwards. Yeah, start with packet two and work backwards, because we can't afford to end up not, because that's what we do after, you know, the last part, dividends and valuation have not been covered in any quiz. So you haven't even looked at them. So cover that part first before you go back and do part one, part two.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I could be right.